There are three broad areas I'd like to cover today. Generally, what are our values as a Muslim? What is the value? What we believe? Second point that I'd like to raise is, what are our challenges as a being Muslim? And the third area, and how far Muslim situation allows you to see their faith as a human creation. I think that is very relevant to see your faith. I think I'd like to cover these three broad areas just as an overview of all this. And I'll hope that we'll have a discussion afterward. But let me tell you the situation the Muslims are in. Even before, as a Muslim I speak, I have been judged. I have to say 8 out of 10 times who I am not before I say who I am. That's the reality that we are living in today's world. I think when we look into the Muslim situation and Muslim belief, and that is the first point, our values. We believe that the human beings are created with two elements. One is the spiritual element, and other is the human, earthly element. In each and every human being, there are two elements exist side by side. One is the spiritual, which is considered highest of the high. Another is the human, which is the earthly part. And it is said in the traditions, Islamic traditions, that if a very pious person comes to you, still you must know there's earthly element in that person. And if a person who you consider is the very bad element, still you consider there's a spiritual part in that. Human beings is always there in that part. In Islamic traditions, again in the Quranic values, it says the human beings are created with two weaknesses. And that is very interesting to look and reflect on. Human beings are forgetful. And secondly, human beings lack determinations. These are the two elements, being human, we carry. That we are human, have some good spiritual part, but also part of being human, being earthly. But at the same time, we are always forgetful and we also lack determination. Again, Islamic traditions, I think the issue of sin and salvation is not the prominent issue. Sin is human condition. Making mistake is part of being human. And therefore, only thing I need to know is that yes, I have done a mistake and I must correct it. Return. What is the concept of tawbah in Arabic? That you return to your good deeds. And you always overcome bad deeds with your good deeds. Salvation is not central to Islamic thought as such. It's not the core understanding of Islamic belief. And in the whole idea of sin and salvation, the concept that the human beings inherited sins will be unacceptable in Islamic thought. Sin is something equals mistake, and it could be corrected by forgiveness, asking forgiveness, and doing good deeds. And human beings have this clear understanding that the salvation is not so crucial, but what is important is to remind that you have to do good and to say that you have an obligation towards your Creator to do good. Now let me come to the same part, but another area that Islam also talks about human beings, three most important parts that they have borrowed from the Creator. That's the intellect, and number two is speech, and number three, will. As if God has borrowed from human being has borrowed from their Creator, from God, intellect, so they can use that intellect in their day-to-day life. Has this expression of speech, they can express themselves freely, and they have a will. I think these are the three broad concepts has been discussed in Islamic traditions. The central core book or central values that Quran is Quran in Islamic traditions. But the subject matter of Quran is human beings. Therefore, in Islamic tradition, there is not theology, but jurisprudence comes into it. It is the relation between human and human that counts more than relation with God. In Quranic traditions, there are very few verses or few sentences about prayer, but more how to relate to another human being. Day-to-day relationship between families, relation with the others. And therefore, Islamic tradition locates its relation in those human interpersonal relationship and calls itself jurisprudence that you relate to. I'll come back to that part a little later. Again, Quran is not an encyclopedia that you open and you'll get every answer to that. Quran gives you basic principles, and from there you develop your own concept and ideas. Now that is the very core. That's the difference. That's the soul of Quran has been fought at the moment. Some say not everything is in the Quran, directly, indirectly. But larger opinion is, Quran is from where you derive your principles in the context that you are living and the time that you are living. So that's a different approach. When I looked into Quran, there are four core values that Quran talks to. And the Quranic values are in Arabic called Rahmah, translated as mercy. The dominant aspect of that is mercy. And it says in the Quran, كَتَبَ عَلَى نَفْسِهِ رَحْمَةً, that God has ordained on Himself mercy. That is the character that God says, I have ordained on myself mercy. In the end, the face that will remain is the face of mercy. Second is maghfirah, or forgiveness. The dominant Quranic theme has always been forgiveness. And it's even at the point where a person is killed, it says, yes, you have a right for justice. Go through the legal process. But it's always good to look into forgiveness aspect and return. The third aspect is adl, or justice. Justice has now been interpreted in the different ways, and different interpretation has been assigned to Quran, a concept of justice. Does justice also seen today as a sense of revenge? And that is not justice. It's completely different. But the fourth aspect, which is very difficult to translate for me into English, is ihsan, which means that whatever you do, do best, in a best way. If you have a service to God, a service to your Creator, do it in a best way. Not as a duty and burden, but as a beauty and relation to your Creator. If these are the values, what happened to the Muslim world? I think that question will remain in many minds, quite rightly. And that's what I like to relate and develop a little bit, the current or the Muslim situation at the moment. If these are the values that you have the intellect, you have free speech, you have will, you have a mercy as a dominant aspect, forgiveness as a dominant aspect, justice, and doing good, what happened to the Muslim world? Now that is the part that I like to start, probably 1,000 years of a history, very quickly. Until 1250, the fall of Baghdad, Muslim thought and Western philosophical traditions went hand in hand. They understood each other very clearly, to the extent that they quoted each other, whether it's Aquinas on the one hand or Al-Ghazali on the other. They were in the same wavelength, same world view, philosophical traditions, philosophical aspects and other things. And lots of writings in Islamic traditions influenced the West, and Western philosophical tradition influenced the West Islamic philosophy and Islamic thought. But the fall of Baghdad in 1250, the intellectual philosophical traditions was in decline. And what we see is that philosophy has been seen as something to be dissociated with. It is not a good science. And increasingly, in religious schools or schools in Islamic history, philosophy has been almost abandoned. And logic, with elementary logic, was introduced as a subject, elementary part. But the philosophy as a wider thought is even today, I would say that is missing in that part. And I'll come back to that, what's the difference in that part. While this trend was going on, a Muslim scholar, even in that declining period, was able to contribute in religious discourse or social discourse or jurisprudence or any other sciences with confidence that the religious scholar was a scholar of both sciences. Then comes another problem, the problem of colonial history, colonialism. The colonialism, the colonial past, created a great impact on Muslim world, with the exception of two countries, Afghanistan and current Saudi Arabia. All Muslim worlds were under the rule of the colonial period, colonial empire. And what happened? As soon as colonialization happened, Muslims responded differently. The colonial leadership or colonial masters were eager to produce clerks, not scholars. They have to run an empire. The clerks were produced. Those who can read and write and do small work and civil service who can run the state, but not thinkers. The madaris or the madrasa which produce even at the declining age were also has to respond to colonial past, colonial empire. The result was that the large number of Muslims decided that the colonialism is something is here and one day it will pass and will move on. And therefore there is no need to engage with the current world, the contemporary world. The priority was preservation, not engagement. And the madaris or the madrasa or the seminaries that produced religious scholars were of this opinion in most of the Muslim world, that we do not need to engage with the current world. It is not for us. It is evil. It is something that we do not want to engage. And therefore, we need to preserve. Traditional approach, traditionalism becomes the most important element in all these discussions. There was another group of people and scholars. They said there is no need for seminaries and traditional schools. Modernity is the salvation. Western salvation is Western science and technology is the salvation, not necessarily intellectual traditions. It's the science and technology that influence the Muslim world. And the secularism in its worst form was accepted. And here I can give you the example of Turkey, that the secularization by force was imposed on the Muslim world. And science and technology becomes the most important part of modernity. Modern means science and technology. And after the colonial period, when the colonial period was over, the leadership was shifted in the hands of those who were influenced by Western, secular, but Marxist-oriented, largely capitalist-oriented leadership. And in many Muslim countries, it's the military rulers who rule the countries. So you can see, on the one hand, there were people who do not want to engage with. They didn't want to enter into any debate and discussions. They thought West and Western thought is evil. On the other hand, people who represented the Western thought were largely dictators and military rulers. Or, in some countries, kings were appointed by the Western powers to rule the Muslim world at that time. The third group that emerged, it says, no, let us look into slightly differently. Not everything is bad in the Western thought and ideas. And there is a lot needs to be changing within Islamic tradition. There is a need to change in Muslim world. So you have all three groups exist in the Muslim world. Each has its own influence and all three still exist. The traditional school still believes that 200 years of earlier syllabus is absolutely necessary to bring out religious leadership. And seminaries in the Muslim world is largely controlled by them. Modernist school in Muslim world is also brought not salvation, but pain and suffering. And I mean people, whether it's Saddam Hussein or King of Iran or anybody, and the rulers. Now, in this part, after the independence, after the freedom of Muslim societies and creation of number of countries, what was much needed, absolutely necessary, was debate in the Muslim world, engage with the wider society, and discover the past in relation to contemporary world. That was what was required. But that debate did not take place, and not taking place. Very rarely those debates taking place in the Muslim world, simply because the Muslim world is not a free world. You cannot have a free thinking in a dictatorial regimes where the books for the library are vetted and the committees are there to see what you are reading, and even the foreign students who study in some of these countries has to go through the checks that yes, your thought is right direction. Now, how can you produce a group of scholars who can debate, argue, and leadership who can discuss these things openly? Then there's another old problem as well. The political agenda, the political domination of the West has created an image. The West is monolithic, and West is political. West's philosophical discourse, music, art, is literature, is the varieties of the West has forgotten. West has been seen from political angle and as the other. I remember some years ago, I think, young people asked me to give a talk on Islam and the West. See the emphasis, and the West. It's not in the West, and the West. So I said to these 50 or so young people who are born and brought up here, I said, you gave me the topic, now tell me what is the West. There was silence. Somebody says, well, there are many Christians. I said, in that case, Philippines is a Western country. He said, no, that's not a Western country. Someone says, no, it is a direction. I said, okay, we're sitting in the Los Angeles, and from there the direction changes. It may be different West. He said, no, that's not the West. Said, what is the West? So the concepts, the thought, are not clear even here, even the people who are born and brought up here. Sometimes I provoke young people saying, we are the West. We live here, we contribute here, we engage here, and therefore now we are the part of Western thought and actions. And you can see the hesitation. But that's the reality of that. As I said, the Muslim perception of the others is shaped by political conditions and political realities in the Muslim world. I think what we need in the Muslim traditions is some imaginative discourse. And where it will come from? I think the debate that is taking place about the soul of Islam is largely in European and Western American, North American societies. And I believe that the future would be that there would be a contribution from the Muslims who are born and brought up here. Because at least they are free to think and debate and discuss. And therefore, I can see that in next two generations, you'll have Islam with European accent. It will be distinctly different from South Asia, Malaysia, or Middle East. And the Islam that we talked about here in European Western society, its discourse will be dominantly human rights, gender issues, and relations of revelation to the Western contemporary society. And minority jurisprudence. What is the meaning of living as a minority? Remember, Muslim thought are dominantly a thought of majority, of ruling. And that all the rulings and jurisprudence is related to that political, that part, as a dominantly Muslim part. Sometimes I have discussions with our Jewish friends. He said, we do not know as a Muslim how to handle being a minority. And you do not know how to handle as a power. You lived for 2,000 years as a minority, you do not know how to handle a power. That's the reality between Jews and Muslims at the moment. But the problem is, almost 40 to 42% Muslims live as a minority for many, many centuries. My own family, for 6 or 7 generations, live as a minority. Never lived in a Muslim world. But yet we are Muslim. But the religious language or emphasis that we will use as a being minority is not being used people who live in majority society. So, even today, in the European society, Muslims are trying to relate to a new jurisprudence, new way of thinking. But yet, the sources of information is of majority. Very rarely we discuss how Muslims lived as a minority. Now, there's another debate which comes quite often in Europe. And that is a very important part for me to discuss this one. There's a pressure on Muslims to integrate, participate, integrate in the Western society or Western European culture. But my question is the integration enough? Let us look at it, the height of Jewish integration in German societies was 1920s, 1930s. They even wanted to forget their history. Even they wanted to forget that they are Jews. They are German. They spoke with German accent, German culture, German music, German everything. Yet, what happened to the Jewish people? The height of Muslim assimilation or integration, whatever you call, in Europe was Bosnia. They were integrated to the extent, as Mustafa Sherish, one of the Mufti, said, we were even terrified of even terrified means even wanted to respect to our neighbor, that we didn't want to use Quranic verse which says something difficult for our neighbors, different than others. We were integrated to the extent. But then what happened to Muslim society? And here it comes, the poisonous virus that goes everywhere. When the Bosnian Muslims faced the atrocities that they faced, they were not asked, why you didn't integrate? They were asked, what happened 900 years ago? Jewish people suffered. They were not asked why you didn't integrate. What happened, your character, hundreds of thousands of years, hundreds of years ago, your relations with the things. So I feel that the integration is not the answer, but yet I believe participation is the answer. You must participate with your values, but society is better and society is good, and well-being of people is absolutely necessary. The virus that I was talking about is also important in the part that we live together in Asian society. Hindus and Muslims live side by side. Buddhist, I remember myself living in India, born in India. Our neighbors were Buddhist, Hindus, Christians, and the people of no faith, or tribal or aborigines, or other place. These four groups, we were lived next to each other. We shared festivals of each other. Death in somebody else was death as if in my family. We called each other's elders uncle, auntie. And their other children was like my brother, my sister. Yet, there was a perception of the other. I have hidden a view about the other person because we never explored together. We lived in India most dialogically ever possible, but we never discussed theology. When I came to England, we always discussed theology but never lived dialogically. You see, that's the reality of that. In Indian context, we never explore what is so important to other person. And therefore, we inherited a suspicion of the other. And that suspicion of the other explodes at some time. And that's what happened in Bosnian situation. And that happens quite often in Indian context. And therefore, my concern would be, in any interfaith, or any interfaith, exploring the otherness of the other is absolutely necessary. What is so important in the other person? What is so essential in the other person? What makes that person so important? I think that must be explored, discussed, and valued. Even in Quranic injunction, it says, if God will, He could have made all one nation. Differences of religion, differences of worldview is plan of God. Let us say, that you cannot debate that differences will remain forever. How to relate with each other is a human burden. And how we relate honestly with each other is equally important. Otherwise, that virus will attack in our situation. Now, what we need, I think, before I sum up these discussions, I feel there's a need of transformation of thought. We must transform our thought. See the other partner. I think when I see the transformation of thought, it is not so much what I think about the other and the value of the otherness of the other, but also to see the other as a partner in the well-being of the society. If I use the Christian term, witness, then we need to have a co-witness about the society. With your values, your thought, and our thought, we need to have some sort of engagement and working together in this world. Transformation of thought is absolutely necessary. But it's also important that transformation of theology is equally important. You cannot transform without transforming the theology. Now, I'll give you one interesting example. I had in front of me nearly 40 imams. These are the religious scholars, Muslim scholars, living in Britain. And they are imams in different mosques. They are the community leaders. They also gave me a topic, Islam in and the West. How to deal, how to engage with that. This is some years ago, and then I said that as far as I know the Islamic tradition demands from an imam or a scholar that he must know the cultures, customs and practices of the people that he lives with, around them. Cultures and practices. That's an essential part of training an imam, giving religious opinion. So I said that the understanding of Western thought is enlightenment thought, is history, is culture of secular values, is also part of Western customs and practices. Are we teaching that in our seminary? Because the history of Britain is enlightenment inheritance, is philosophical tradition, is important part imam must know, must understand. Secondly, understanding of religion, even your own Islam, will not be richer unless you understand the Judeo-Christian traditions that contributed in Europe. And therefore, the understanding of Judeo-Christian tradition from Judeo-Christian sources taught by them is equally important. If we are not fulfilling this part, then we are wrong. If not, please correct me. So there was silence for another minute or so. And they said, whatever you are saying is right, but we do not know how to handle this question. It's very difficult for us. So what it needs, a transformation of theology has to be challenged within each tradition, saying that there is another way of looking things in this part. And of course, and in success also lies in a transformation of socio-political debate that is going on. I think that is equally important. Now I'll come to the last point, and that is, what's the Islamic thought and solution or approach to human reasoning? There was an incident in the Prophet's time. And Prophet asked Mu'adh bin Jabal, one of the very close companions, that I am sending you to Yemen to work. There's something about the situation in that part, to help those people there. Now tell me how you will judge people, how you will work in that part. What would be guiding principle would be? And he said, Quran. And he said, if you don't find there? Now this is a very important thing. If you don't find anything there, what you'll do? I'll try to look into your traditions. And he said, if you don't find there, if you don't see that in our traditions, what you will do? And he said, I will use my own reasoning. And Prophet said, you are in the right direction. Go on and move. The Muslim situation is that the book or the principles of Quran and prophetic tradition will remain core, but it has to adapt in the context that we are living. It has to be contextualized. It has to accommodate the concerns that and situation that we are living in. And it's not something new. In Islamic history, that has been done. That is done consistently by the jurists and religious scholars. They adapted the condition in which we are living. The debate that is taking place in the Muslim world, particularly in European context, is Sharia, the most dreaded word, Sharia, which I have my own problem when I see Sharia has been implemented as if there is something here to implement. Sharia doesn't have a book of Sharia that you implement. Sharia is a path that leading to the water. That's the literal meaning. But the Sharia also is, you must take account of the context in which we are living. Participation of others in those. So here what I find is that the whole idea, the issue of human rights, which is now there is a consensus, that is, there is a set of standards that we must follow. And I believe that could easily be part of Islamic traditions in that. And the contemporary jurists and contemporary Islamic scholars are debating those issues and saying, let us accept that as a part of collective a consensus of the of humanity on the standard of human rights, that at least we will follow that. At least we'll do that much. Science and technology and all other areas are now debated. The values is that what I'm trying to say is that as far as the reasoning and reasoning is concerned, it will always be applied with the religion and religious basic values. And that reasoning has a major part to play in shaping the theology of the future. Thank you very much.